You're listening to World Affairs. I'm Philip Young. More than 60% of the world's employed population work in the so-called informal sector. That's 2 billion people. Some pick vegetables. Some work on construction sites. Others are street vendors or domestic workers. Many of these people depend on the money they make each day for their survival. Staying home can be a choice between hunger and exposure to the coronavirus. And the consequences of their decisions affect us all.
The harsh reality is that at this moment, the pandemic is reaching many countries that have a high number of vulnerable people. And therefore, we need to find ways in which we can address both the containment of the pandemic and the economic and social fallout.
That's Hakeem Steiner. He heads the United Nations Development Program. He's proposing a bold global initiative, one he says could slow down coronavirus infections around the world and keep people from falling into extreme poverty. What if the world's governments provide a temporary basic income? It's a version of something economists have been studying for some time. It's called Universal Basic Income, or UBI. The notion of guaranteeing a basic income is now gaining traction. This week, we take a deep dive into the world of UBI. Ray Suarez starts us off.
You're hearing the sound of payday at a refugee settlement in Uganda. People are waiting patiently to receive a basic income payment from the nonprofit group Give Directly. But there's an energy in the crowd. You can hear groups of people talking loudly and a person or two singing. I've seen the impact of on-the-ground UBI programs directly when I reported in the Central Highlands of Mexico. I spent several days there and saw how the payments supported local households, marketplaces, and schools. It was really something, but the real eye-opener was being there on cash day. And an enormous truck and armed soldiers and armed truck drivers, and I thought, holy! I mean, they open up the back of the truck and there's piles of cash. It was amazing to see. An empty dirt field just became a marketplace on cash day. These people came up, they set up booths, they set up tarps and tents and lean-tos, and suddenly there's this, with streets and alleys, in this empty field, there's now a sort of shopping center because everybody's got this hot money in their hands. It was really fascinating to watch. Now, this was back when the primary method of payment was in cash, but today, payday is mostly digital.
I can just literally upload a spreadsheet and say, click, send, done, and I know it's there. No one's going to get robbed. Nothing's going to happen along the way. The money will arrive in 30 seconds, all done.
That's Tavneet Suri. She's an MIT scholar studying the effects of UBI in Kenya, in East Africa. Welcome to World Affairs.
Great. Thanks, Strayan. Thanks for having me.
Without getting too jargony or too deeply technical, could you give me a thumbnail description of what a universal basic income program is and how it works in Kenya?
Sure. A universal basic income program is where we guarantee people a basic income that covers kind of very basic necessities, food, a bit of education, maybe a bit of health. In Kenya, we're doing a study that gets about 20,000 people a basic income. And we're studying kind of how this changes their lives, affects their decisions, affects their ability to become entrepreneurs, affects their health, affects their children's health, affects aspirations, all sorts of things. It's a small scale study trying to understand the benefits and any costs the UBI might have. And the other piece of our study, Ray, which is kind of cool, we kind of have a group that's getting a short-term UBI for 2 years. There's a group getting a 12-year UBI. We've guaranteed them 12 years of a basic income. And there's a group that got kind of the 2-year equivalent in lump sum. The way the UBI works in the other arms is you kind of get a payment every couple of weeks. Each individual gets a payment every couple of weeks. And so we're kind of trying to understand both kind of what's the impact of a UBI as well as kind of design issues around the UBI, you know, how frequent, how long. And so hopefully over the next, you know, several months and several years, will be able to grow the evidence base around a program like this.
Now, looking at a country like Kenya, in a part of the world that already has economic burdens, but now has the added challenge of COVID-19, governments have limited funds, so why is UBI a good place to put that money?
I think what we're trying to do is try to understand whether UBI is really the best place to put that money or not. I think certainly during COVID, cash transfers of some sort have been a widely used policy in all emerging markets and all developing countries. As you start to institute some sort of constraints on mobility, constraints on meetings, constraints on markets happening, you kind of do need to supplement people's income, especially at the bottom end of the income distribution. And so there's been probably close to 1,000 cash transfer programs rolled out since COVID started. I think the number we have is 195 countries introduced 1,000 new social protection measures covering almost 2 billion people over the last several months until June. And so the usual way to deal with some big unanticipated risk like this is try to protect the downside for people, especially who live close to kind of poverty lines or below poverty lines. I think what we had the opportunity to do is we've been running a huge randomized controlled trial of universal basic income in Kenya for the last couple years. And we had kind of our first set of data come in before COVID hit. And what it allowed us to do was to go back to these communities in May and June and just see whether the UBI was helping people deal with what was coming their way and deal with some of the uncertainty surrounding COVID, some of the ways of dealing with COVID, and whether it kind of helped protect them a little more than others who were not getting the UBI.
As you mentioned, a lot of countries have been doing a lot of different things. Some of these subsidies have taken the form of direct subsidy to business, subsidizing the cost of basic products in the marketplace, subsidizing rents, giving people added unemployment insurance. Depending on the country, depending on the circumstances, there have been a lot of different forms. When you look at a country like Kenya, with a large informal sector, with a large subsistence sector, and very low incomes throughout the country, what's the appeal of universal basic income?
I think you nailed all the bits and pieces of this in the question. So, you know, it's a poor country. It has a lot of informal business. The way we've seen credit go out to formal businesses, this is really hard to do in a country like this, because very few businesses are formal and very few have bank affiliations in the first place. And so rolling out, even if it's subsidized credit or guaranteed credit from the government, is just not going to help that many people. That's one. The second is a lot of people are in agriculture, growing food, selling food, trying to get to markets. And some of the COVID restrictions might affect their ability to do those things because the markets aren't there anymore. And so even though they would traditionally sell food to get income, that might be stopped just by the restrictions, not necessarily even the disease, but just this notion that we don't want people to assemble in large ways. So that's another piece of this. I think the third piece is something we're finding out of the surveys we did before COVID hit in Kenya. So this is the end of last year. The one thing UBI had let people do is to start businesses. Not everybody, but we got an increase in entrepreneurship and starting enterprises. So non-agricultural enterprises. And that's because the UBI protects your downside, right? When I'm worrying all the time about whether I can feed my kids, I might not do high risk, high return things because if it doesn't work out, oh my God, I can't feed my kids, correct? So what the UBI does is kind of let you know, oh, I can feed my kids. So now I can try all these new things and I can take some risk because I know that at the end of the day, there's food and there's healthcare on the table. And I won't have to worry that if this doesn't work out, I won't be able to feed my kids. So we do see an increase in businesses as a result of the UBI before COVID hits. And then, you know, by May or June, we're seeing those businesses are still around. They're not making as much money. Some of that is COVID. Some of that is the agricultural cycle is such that hungry season and COVID hit at the same time in Kenya, right? And so you can't really tell apart a big shock from hungry season or a big shock from COVID. But we do see that these businesses are sort of able to at least survive through this, even though they might not do as well as they were doing before. And so I think that's one of the roles UBI plays, is it really can help protect your downside risk and allow you to therefore take on potentially more risk because you know that your basic needs are met and your basic needs will be met for a while. A lot of the transfer programs or programs that we've seen in response to COVID have been short term, as you've seen. Even in the US, we've had to try and renew them. The plus of the UBI that we've been studying and experimenting with is, you know, one of them is a pretty long term UBI, committing to giving people a UBI for up to 12 years. And so that generates kind of very different behaviors potentially than something that's just, you know, for 2 months while we get through this. A more long-term UBI might have kind of different consequences than something short-term in response to COVID alone.
Are there any specific uses of the money that are encouraged, that are forbidden, that are recommended, that are worried about, or is part of the beauty of it that you just turn over the money and whatever happens, happens?
Yeah, so I should say, Ray, you know, we're running this as a randomized controlled trial to test a UBI. It's not across the whole country. We're working in two of the poorer counties in the country. There's something like 20,000 people in this experiment getting a UBI of some sort. And we've been kind of following it for about 2 years. It started about 2 years ago. And like I said, one group, it's going to run for 12 years. The way we structured the study was, no, they get the cash. With two subgroups of people, we gave them slight nudges in the experimental design. We told some people just to plan how they were going to spend the money and just say, you know, it might be good to have a plan. Why don't you make a plan for how you're going to spend the money? And in one, we kind of nudged that there were financial products they could use, like savings accounts and stuff, if they wanted to try and save some of it. But we didn't really require anybody to do anything with it, good or bad. The point of the study is to kind of understand what something like this does. If I just hand people a basic income, how does it change both individuals' people's lives? It's universal in the community, so everybody gets it in those communities, which means rich or poor, you get it. And so the questions we're trying to understand is, how does it affect individuals' people's lives? How does it affect the communities that they're in when everybody is getting a basic income, right? So you could think that, you know, the schools aren't great and the community gets together and says, look, we have this basic income. Why don't we try to invest in the schools and improve the schools ourselves? There's a whole bunch of things that could change in the community as well, not just in individuals' people's lives. We're also trying to track things that people think of the downside. We're trying to measure labor supply. Do people keep working? We're trying to measure, is there, you know, an increase in crime because there's money in the community now? Is there increases in prices? If we all go out and buy food, Ray, guess what happens to the price of food? It goes up. So we're measuring all those bits and pieces. We don't have all the analysis in, but we will in a couple months. But the first piece is coming through, like I mentioned, where we do see people start new businesses. We see before seasonality and COVID hit, their businesses were doing, they were earning more money out of them. Some of this declined during the COVID period or during May, June. And then we do see improvements in physical and mental health that are quite strong. And we see improvements in food security. Like people are less hungry and more food secure as a result. So those are kind of the three big pieces. You know, people seem to be spending it on food, on starting businesses, and on investing in their health.
I ask because some cash transfer programs are very programmatic, like Oportunidades in Mexico, where you have to keep your kids in school, you have to attend classes. They give the money to the women of the household rather than the men of the household, in part because they think the money will be better spent and it enhances women's independence and their power inside the household. Part of that is because they think it's good program design, and part of it is because it goes down easier politically at scale. to know that there are some conditions in place for getting that money.
Yeah, correct. Those are conditional cash transfers, Ray. That is correct. There's a whole host of them that condition on schooling, on immunizations is another one, getting your kids immunized. The notion of a UBI is not conditional. It's completely unconditional. It's universal. It's basic. It goes to everybody. No conditions. The other conditions you could think of was only giving it to poor people or something. So we did not do that because the UBI notion is we should give it to everybody without conditions and let them decide how to use it. I think the point of our study is to see, like, basically, how do they use it? You know, are they going to spend on education and health of their kids? Are they going to spend on investments that make them better off, that kick them out of a poverty trap, maybe? Who knows? So I think that's the point of the study, Ray, is to really understand what this would do before you try to scale it out everywhere. The second piece I will say, just for our study, we gave it to every adult directly. So both the man and the woman in the household got a basic income. So it's an individual basic income going to every individual in the community. Oh, sorry, every adult, I should say, in the community. We're analyzing right now the results on women's economic empowerment, you know, a whole bunch of how they use the money, do they start businesses, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm hoping we'll have a more complete picture in the next couple months as the rest of the data and analysis comes in.
Is part of the idea to build a floor underneath people's feet? It's not to make poor people rich or middle class people rich. It's to make sure that nobody gets too poor, right?
That's one piece of it, Ray, for sure. The other piece, the way I like to think about it, is really this. Sometimes poor people will make investments that are not very high return, right? I'll invest in a low risk thing because it provides me stability and certainty. And so if that's true, then providing me a floor means I don't have to worry about uncertainty as much. That's one piece of it. The other way to think about it is, you know, we know that insurance markets don't work for poor people in these countries. We know credit markets don't really work for them. We know labor markets don't really work. You know, in the Hungary season, you can't really go get a job because there's nothing to sort of be hired to do, right? So when all this sort of stuff around you doesn't function that well, trying to direct transfers to one of those bits functioning better seems to have this notion that maybe everything needs to be fixed and targeting one thing might not be enough. And this allows people to kind of figure out, you know, what are the constraints that bind for me and what are the most important ones for me? And so let me invest in those if I have the money to do that. We have learned over the last N years that even though people are poor, they're very different even when they're poor. They have different constraints and different decisions and different access to schools and health and all sorts of things. And so maybe letting them figure out what's the best way to handle their own constraints might work.
Well, that gets right to the heart of what it means to be poor in much of the world, doesn't it? I mean, there's always been this argument about whether poor people are poor because of conditions that are imposed upon them, or in part because of the choices they make with the limited resources they have. Here you take resources somewhat out of the equation. They know that if something doesn't work this month, they're still going to get their subsidy next month, which allows a different kind of time horizon when you think about money. Is that it?
Yeah, absolutely. They're getting a bit of money every couple weeks, right? It arrives on their phone digitally. And so we designed this explicitly to pick up that piece, Ray, which is, if I know it's going to be there for a while, does it change how I make every decision? Because it's not just the resources, but it's also knowing that the resources are going to be there tomorrow. And so I'm hoping we'll be able to say something about that piece too from the study, which is sometimes even just knowing that it's going to be around for a while might enable you to think about the world differently. Like we would here if we have a stable job. I know I'm getting paid every month because this is what I do, right? And so trying to create some of that stability and providing people certainty over that stability might change the entire way they view their lives.
I'm wondering if there isn't a little bit of a trap involved here. I'll explain what I mean. When people talk speculatively about these kinds of programs, there's always a Greek chorus that comes in from the wings and says, oh my God, we don't know that this is going to work. We don't know how it works. We don't know what works. You can't do that. So the research community says, okay, fine. We'll test out how it works by doing it in this small controlled area to gain some understanding of how people behave and what people do and what difference the money makes. And then you present that data, and that same Greek chorus comes rolling in from the wings and says, oh, but you could never do this at scale. There's no money to make sure that this could be done in 1,000 villages in Kenya or 5,000 villages in Kenya. So what's the point? You're creating this discrete little microeconomy. You're proving something that, well, who even needed it to be proved? And I see a little bit of that in some of the critiques that are already out there about pilot programs involving universal basic income.
Yeah, Ray, this is a good question. One of the beauties of what's happened over the last decade in some of these economies is this entire digitization of lives that's happening. Mobile phones are changing the way people function and run their financial lives completely. And so, you know, to be honest, all of our cash transfers are going out over mobile phones into mobile money. So it's a digital transfer that takes, you know, a click of a button, basically, or a piece of code written. So scaling something like that is just not going to be that hard, right? I don't have people running around the middle of nowhere handing out cash in person. I agree. Something like that, oh boy, would we struggle to scale it. And the costs of even getting a universal basic income out would be maybe higher than the actual universal basic income you're giving. So we have to realize that a lot of these transfers will be delivered digitally. And that just takes a lot of transaction costs, pure delivery costs out of the system. I think it could take out a bunch of leakage out of the system. The way we're thinking of these scaling is really the way we're implementing them. It would be done digitally through mobile money systems because that's the only kind of cost-effective way to do these things. And in fact, you mentioned Oportunidades, which has shifted onto debit cards now. And so I think that's going to make all of these sorts of programs just far more cost-effective, far easier to scale, far easier to administer, far easier to monitor, far easier to manage. It's another reason when you come back to conditional cash transfers that you mentioned earlier, Ray, right? With that, I still need to figure out if your kid is in school. And, you know, that might be harder to scale as monitoring every kid being in school before I can pay out the cash transfer. So the other advantages of the universal piece is I just don't have to know that much about what people are doing to be able to do these transfers. It kind of takes out even more costs out of the system and more monitoring and more pieces of things we need for this to be able to scale.
Would a place like Kenya need outside inward investment in order to take a universal basic income program society-wide? If there hasn't been a tremendous run-up in the productivity and output of Kenyan workers, if you're increasing the size of the pie, don't the other slices have to come from somewhere else?
Certainly thinking about, you know, the welfare piece is going to be important, right? How do we manage the welfare state of poorer countries? And, you know, how do we manage aid parts of poorer countries? And I think that's a bigger discussion to be had. You know, they are already doing a bunch of cash transfers. And the question is, you know, are those the right sets of ones to be doing? Should they shift to a UBI? I think ultimately, I think we need to see the results and see how well this does. And if it really changes these communities in a very fundamental way, right? And if that happens, then we can think about how do we design it so that it would scale up, or how would we design it that it scales up to some parts of the population to start with. But I think we truly need to understand what are the benefits and what are the costs, and what's the cost effectiveness in some sense of this. how does it really change these communities? And if it's going to change them in fundamental ways so that they're going to grow more and have more businesses and just be more productive, then we can start to think about, okay, how should we restructure some of the expenses already on the budget line items to try and do some of this? And whether that's, you know, using both revenues that are coming in plus aid, I think that's a discussion to be had.
That's Tavneet Suri. She's a scholar at MIT working on a long-term project in Kenya on how universal basic income changes lives there. Thanks for joining us.
Anytime, Ray. Thanks so much.
You're listening to the weekly broadcast of World Affairs. World Affairs is a nonprofit organization. Please consider supporting the program you value by making a donation at worldaffairs.org. Our program is produced in partnership with KQED, with funding from First Republic and Chevron. This episode was produced by Teresa Katsourilis, Jared Sport, and Joanne Jennings. Hannah Harasaki, Catherine Putz, and Tatum Sanderback provided research assistance. Our technical supervisor is Jim Bennett. I'm Philip Yun. Thank you for listening.